right, so
hi. Like, I don't have the fancy microphone, so
you didn't get the memo that you needed to have a fancy microphone for the interview.
In this episode of Immigration Revelation, you're gonna meet Fiona's longtime client, who had us laughing, crying. It was such a good time. Meet Wally Mafolazir.
Okay, all right. I just want to make sure I'm not going to get a bill from Fiona after this.
Yeah, I'll send you.
You know how attorneys are.
No, we're the good type of attorneys. That's what I say to people. I'm a tree-hugging immigration lawyer, you know.
Wally is a Nigerian-born U.S. immigrant. He's also the founder and CEO of Givelify, one of the fastest-growing philanthropic platforms in the world. Through its innovative approach to giving, Givelify is connecting nonprofit and faith-based organizations directly with their members and donors. You'll hear all about this amazing company from Wally himself, and the leaps of faith it took to turn Givelify from a feeling into an application that has helped raise over $1 billion in generous donations.
But thanks for your time. I know how valuable it is, and we are very grateful. Where are you as we speak? Where are you right now?
I'm in my home office in Dallas.
Oh, you're in Dallas?
Yes, yes.
How's everything? Yeah. Everyone's staying safe and hunkering down? And
well, yeah, we're making the best of the situation. So I have a five-year-old who is in kindergarten, and so he's going through the motions of that right now. But they're on fall break, I understand. Like, why are you even getting a break? You're 5 years old. Like, you should be in school.
You know, kindergarten is very stressful.
I guess. That's what...
No. Breaks are for the teachers, Wally.
It's not for
Here in the U.S., you have to be five on September 1st to start kindergarten. But in Ireland, it's just like, come on in. How old are you? Fine, whatever. You can just start. So, hey, what's the school system like at home for like starting school in Nigeria?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably closer to the Irish way of approaching this, right? It's if your parents think you're at that age and maturity level, or they just want you to get there fast, they just put you there. And
yeah.
So his school gave us the option of doing in person and remote. But since we have a seven-month-old who's still going through the motions of vaccinations, we decided to just do remote.
So did you guys have a baby in the pandemic, or was it just before? You said your baby's 7 months old.
Yeah, so very interesting, Fiona, right? So we had just set up a new office in Indianapolis that literally signed a new lease. We moved into the new office, bigger space. Took up the entire floor of our building downtown Indianapolis. And we had moved in January. By the end of February, this COVID situation is happening. And it's like, okay, all right, well, everybody just start working from home. And we'll let you know if we could come back maybe in March or April. And of course, this is November, and we're still telling everybody work from home. So here I have this massive lease with all this fancy furniture. I'm just like, COVID, why couldn't you just have come like 2 months earlier? We spent all this money on this furniture and this five-year lease. But Fiona, to answer your question, is like, I found myself in the same situation with the baby also. It was like, my wife is pregnant. We anticipated a March, end of March due date. And then COVID happens. And then, you know, myself... our five-year-old Olu and her, we go to the hospital, we're here to have a baby, and they're like, well, we'll take mom. Olu and dad, sorry, we can't take you. You have to go home.
Really?
Yeah, and so she had to she had to have the baby by herself. No, nobody was ready for this, because this was just right at the beginning of COVID, so.
Oh my gosh.
So that was
that's hard.
It was for her, you know. I can just imagine all the emotions she was going through being on her own in there. So
being on her own. Look, I've had two kids, and I guess the good thing is it was your second baby, which tends to be faster than the first baby, but still it's not easy.
I don't know, because I wasn't there for the second one.
Before Wally lived in Dallas with his newly minted family of four, He lived in Nigeria with his mom, dad, and younger sister and brother. So what exactly led Wally to move to the US?
Do you want the politically correct one or the real thing?
Let's go with the real version, Wally.
Yeah, well, I trust Fiona would do a good job of presenting me in the best light, so I'm not,
of course.
I'm not worried.
Yes. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, it is. It's literally my job.
Yeah, there we go. So, growing up in Nigeria, I had an uncle who had studied in Canada, and he always felt like there was opportunities to be exposed to Western education, to some of the best universities in the world by coming to this part of the world. And so he always advocated for, if there was an opportunity for us to come and do our university education in the United States. And he thought, you could come here and get degrees that would be recognized to any part of the world. And so very early on, and he spent some time in London also. And so I'm getting ready to graduate from college. He starts exposing me to the British A-level exams, right? And I had to take those. So I did the O-levels and the A-levels, and then I sat for the SATs. And at some point in time, I had the option of actually either going to the United Kingdom or coming to the United States. And as an 18, maybe 19 year old, you watch a lot of television. Daytona Beach, MTV Spring Break, Party Weekend, Pandemonium, and Freak Out. And you get to see all this MTV Spring Break on the beach. Spring Break until it breaks, get ready to And you're like, you know what? That looks like where I want to be for college.
That looks more fun than the coast of England.
If you want to be politically correct, it looks warmer.
It looks warmer. There we go. Okay, all right.
Yeah, I'm from Miami, so I'm from the city that people spring break at. So
yeah, I was going to say.
You're right. So yeah, that's what you see on MTV. You see the Miami beach spring break.
I was an hour and a half away from the beach. People are like, oh, you were at the beach the whole time. I'm like, no, I avoided the beach.
So the lure of the MTV spring break, you're like, that seems like an awesome place to go to college.
I mean, if I have an option.
How about
we go see what this looks like?
See what that's about.
But that's the mind of a 19-year-old guy, right? So what else is there to say? So one way or the other, I found myself studying in the United States.
Before you moved here for college, had you ever visited the U.S.? Had you ever come to?
No, I had never visited. Actually, I had I'd visited London a few times, but I had never been to the United States. So that was my first experience.
And Wally was fully expecting that experience to be like his MTV Spring Break dream, with the beach, the parties, the highly respected academic institutions. And, I mean, he definitely got that last one. Two, if you count the Chattahoochee River as the beach.
I ended up in Columbus, Georgia, which...
That's not it.
I quickly came to realize that the spring break images that I used to see on MTV was not everywhere in the United States.
Yeah, not like, yeah, all over.
It's not like...
So, Wally went to the U.S. to Columbus State University in Georgia.
Well, I'm very excited because, like, I don't have my dad there trying to give me curfew, so I'm going far, far away from him. He just can't pop up in my dorm room.
Yeah.
Or so he thought, because he really only had about 2 years to enjoy some semi-unsupervised fun time in college before.
So I'm here in the United States 2 years, 2 years into my program. My parents won the diversity lottery program.
Oh, amazing.
And right around when that's happening, my younger brother and sister were graduating high school also with the hopes of coming to join their big brother in the United States to study as well. And so they had this very, call it luck, intersection of the diversity program clicking at a point in time where they're thinking about college as well. So that opportunity came. My mom felt like, look, all my kids are going to be in the United States. I have no business staying in Nigeria by myself, especially when I have this green card program that I've just been eligible for. And so the entire family, my mom, my dad, and my sister moved to the United States at the same time, and we left dad behind to take care of business. So,
okay. Well,
yeah,
that's the huge like benefit of the programs like the diversity green card, you know, the green card lottery. And it's one of the things that's been really hurtful to see over the past few years, talk about getting rid of that and talk, you know, because for people who don't know, it was there to give countries that had historically lower rates of immigration to the US to give those people from those countries an opportunity to come to the US. And I think it's kind of the beauty of the US being that it is, you know, the idea is that there's immigrants from all over. And then, you know, and so I think that's it. I love when I hear people's stories who were the beneficiaries of these types of programs. It just reminds you of the importance of having an avenue, because for your mom and for a lot of other people, they might not have another way to get a green card or to come to the US at all. So and so your mom and then so some of the family came. That must have been amazing, having them come over to join. I mean, I'm sure they weren't like crashing on your dorm room.
So they were here. I was in the US 2 years, and then they came here. So when they came, they went to Indiana. Which, yeah, in a lot of ways, I'm like, yes, I don't have to share my dorm room with them.
That's another spring break state right there. Yeah,
there we go, another spring break state right there. But, you know, one of the things you get to appreciate that is just having lived through that entire thing. My mom was a college professor in Nigeria, and having her pack her bags and say she wanted to come and start all over in the United States at her age. I don't think we ever anticipated how much of a struggle that would have been for her.
Yeah.
For those of us who are coming here for college, I think just coming here, getting to college, making new friends, you're very excited about that. Lots of opportunities, and the whole world is just open to you. But for my mom, I think it was very tough when month after month, she's trying to find her feet and trying to find the right place for her in this society. Even for her with a PhD, she had in order for that PhD to be recognized, she had to redefend her thesis and all of that, right? So for somebody who had earned her PhD years ago and having to try to go through the academic rigor of redoing that all over just for it to be honored by the system was something that was a little bit challenging for her.
Yeah. And I think there's some great groups who, different like nonprofit groups, Upward Eel Mobile, there's a couple of them that help immigrants who are professionals in their home country and who then come to the US. And you see that a lot where people could be, you know, doing essential work in different ways, but not like what they used to do in their home country. And so sometimes it can be a credentials thing, it can be a language barrier, it can be obviously for your mom it wasn't, but you know, it can be just like a people don't know how to put together a US resume or to interview, or you know, there's just a lot of cultural differences, I think.
You know, some of the odd jobs she had to do in that process, right? I remember clearly one day she was a cashier. And it wasn't fun to, yeah, mom, you used to be like this big shot at the university in Nigeria, and now you're a cashier here. And then she did what she had to do. At some point in time, she mopped toilets. But I think the cashier, when I remember very well, because I remember she called me crying, and somehow her register had come up short at the end of the night, and they had accused her of stealing money from the register and fired her. And it wasn't determination that really bothered her, but for her, it was like, you know, here's somebody she's a pastor. She had started churches in Nigeria when she was leaving.
Yeah.
She had donated a lot of her like land properties to her native church to help grow the church, and to be in a situation where she's in this kind of job and,
oh my God,
and she's been accused of stealing pennies was something
that's
that
awful. That's so wrong.
That, yeah.
And I'm sure as well, apart from the kind of the employment situation, like it's kind of lonely to move here as an adult, as a grown up, I'd say, like to my kids, you know, but to, because that's in college, you get the chance to make friends and you to kind of build your network. But and I know that there's a few people that I've known who've moved here, moved to the US later in life, and they kind of feel like they're always, they're kind of torn between like two lands, you know, when they're here, they're with their kid, their older kids, and they're happy, but then their heart might be in their home country and they kind of have that struggle. And so, and did your dad remain in Nigeria or did he come over to the US?
Yeah, so I think my dad always tried to help from back then, from Nigeria. But at some point in time, I think the pressure of having two teenage boys in the United States by themselves just enjoying this newfound freedom of America. Eventually, he decided to come up here also to help his boys keep their heads on right.
Right now. Good.
So he moved here eventually also. But I tell you what, Fiona, that was the, you know, it's amazing how the universe works, because shortly after he moved here, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, stage 4. And thanks to just the wonderful, wonderful medical system here in the United States, was able to live 10 additional years after stage 4 diagnosis, which I doubt might have happened if he still lived in Nigeria. They would have been able to live with that for 10 years before he eventually passed. In a lot of ways, I'm grateful for the circumstances that brought him here, which was to help his two boys get their heads on their shoulder right. But you know, it gives you a different perspective on life as well.
Yeah,
and, you get to appreciate a lot of things.
Definitely, and I want to, you know, pass on my condolences, and also I don't know you. I don't think you know this, but my cousin passed away. He also was diagnosed with prostate cancer at stage 4. And he lived for about 2 years, and he was only like 46 when he died. You know, I think it makes you appreciate just life and health and family. You know, just the access to healthcare here in the US, if people can access it. We definitely have some of the best doctors in the world, and actually a lot of them are immigrants themselves.
No, definitely. Fortunately, my dad's doctor was actually a Nigerian. He's oncologist.
Was he?
But it's you know, it's amazing, right? You go to college and you get to meet all of this. You get to meet all of these different people from different parts of the world, including in the United States. And you just get to appreciate what makes America so great of a country. That immigrant spirit and that different perspective that we all bring from the different parts of the world that we're coming together.
Yeah.
And in situations when you're able to just harness all of that and pull it together, the magic that happens is just phenomenal. We all get to benefit from that.
We'll be right back after a short break.
I talked about my background, about how my mom was a pastor and she had always instilled in me. And I talk about people of faith a lot, about how they're the most generous people on earth, regardless of what your faith is, right? Every faith that I know of preaches charity, right? Help people in need, make sure that you're being a very responsible citizen of the community. And I remember instances where I would go to church, and it's time for me to put something into the offering plate, I would not have cash on me to put there. And I would always say to myself, when I get home and I get in front of a proper computer, I'll go ahead and set up online giving to give to my church. And then service is over, I get home, I start watching all my Sunday evening shows. And one thing leads to the other. It's Monday, Tuesday, and Sunday, I'm sitting back at church. Same scenario. I haven't set up the online giving. I don't have the money to give.
Now you have the guilt of the previous week.
Exactly, of the previous week as well. And so this will go on and on, right? Like, it got up to a point, it's like, okay, like, I know I have to time my exit out of the church service, like, just... Pardon me. 10 minutes before the last prayer, because I didn't want to make eye contact with my pastor. Because I knew I was that guy who showed up every Sunday, enjoyed the services.
No, gosh. And your pastor knows.
Yeah, I know, of course. I know she knows. That's why I was avoiding him.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
And I remember attending this fundraiser. It was not church-related. So some of my friends had invited me to this gala just to come there. So I thought it was fun. Let's go to the gala, have a good time, dress up in our tuxedo, go meet some new friends. Why I showed up at a fundraising gala without my checkbook, Fiona, please don't judge me, but no, I did.
I'm also a person of faith and no judgment.
Okay. So at this fundraiser, I find myself really connecting with the mission of this organization. They help inner city kids that didn't have father figures in their life, just teach them basic skills of manhood. It's, you know, it's just one of those situations where I'm sitting down there and just really appreciating my dad more than I'd ever done. Of some of the things he had done that I had taken for granted, and how this organization actually creates those experiences for people who are not fortunate to have had their dads in their lives. Mm-hmm. I'm like, man, this sounds like something that I could support and get behind. Of course, I don't have my checkbook, so I filled out what they call pledge cards. I don't know if you guys know what those things are.
Yeah.
You write your name and your contact information, and then the organization contacts you with so that you can fulfill your pledge.
Yeah.
In my case, I was so committed to helping this organization that I filled out 2 pledge cards. I turned one into the organization and I took one as my own reminder that even if they don't contact me, this is my reminder that I'll send something to them. A few weeks later, I'm in the office clearing my desk, and guess what I run into? It's my pledge card. I haven't sent the gift. Pretty sure I haven't heard from the organization either. And it was in that moment I realized that there are these moments where I'm inspired to be generous, to just want to be part of something, or that want to give. And I'm realizing that for Wally, if I don't act in the moment, like, this moment's come and go and I forget about it. I was like, there's got to be an app in the app store. Like, there's an app for everything. I see the commercials. There's an app for everything. Where's this app that helps people like me? I looked in the app store. We didn't see any at that point in time. I'm like, you know what? What if I just built one for myself? At the very least, I don't have to be sneaking out of church 10 minutes to the end of service every Sunday. And, you know, if I could solve that problem for myself, that would be great. Little did we know that we're solving that problem for almost 50,000 organizations on our platform today. Almost a million donors who use our app. And this year alone, I've helped those organizations raise almost $1 billion in contributions, right?
1 billion with a B.
With a B.
My goodness.
And historically, those are those are contributions that would not have been captured because of people.
Yeah. Because you're right, though. It's that moment that, like, what you feel in the moment and then you act on it, you know. And if there's a lag between that feeling and then your ability to, like, give, then the moment's gone. And for some people, that's then the donation is gone. And so you turned a necessity, like a need, what's that, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. And so for you solved your own personal problem and have turned this into, like, a huge, huge company.
Yeah, so we're about a little over 100 maybe, but we're hiring like crazy. So let me, a quick plug here.
Please, yes. Yeah. How do people find out about the jobs that you're...
careers.givelify.com. If you're at that point in your career where you feel like you've done enough with your skills and your talent, and you're very in tune with, hey, how can I just not do what I love doing, but how does it help put more good into the world? You're the exact kind of person we're looking for.
Wally knows the importance of having diversity in our teams and communities. Because when you've personally benefited from that diversity, how can you not advocate for it?
And I wish I could take all the credit for this, but again, this goes back to how America just helps bring these kind of things to life in its own way, right? There's a survival skill you kind of pick up as when you're in this country by yourself that helps translate into these kind of opportunities, right? So when I first started here, I remember my first car, I paid $300 for it. Fiona, I'll never forget this, right? So this car broke down on the road.
For $300, what a surprise.
But the thing I learned with that car was I'd never been a mechanic, right? But things like just learning how to change my own oil. I remember at some point in time, the shocks went out, went to YouTube, figured how to change your shock absorbers, change your
not
gas.
Not recommended for those at home. do not do that, please.
Not recommended, you're right. But those hardships, there's just things that build in you that translate later on in life into just trying to figure out how to get things done.
Yeah.
And when I talk about the Givelify story, the part that I missed out is when the idea came to me and I started working on it. At first, I was doing it by myself and I realized it was a lot of work. I went to some of the friends that I'd made while I was in college, Harry being one of them, Fiona. Mm. You know Harry very well.
Absolutely. Yes, we do. Yeah.
So, and it's amazing how the connection happened. So Harry and I were college roommates.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, we were.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. So we used to fight a lot as roommates. We still do as colleagues at work. Yeah, so it was just like, well, here you are with one of these your things again, or whatever. What do you need me to do, right?
Yeah.
And we started working on it together. And there was a point in time that, you know, we were really, really cash strapped for a few things. There was one of my friends also who's a medical doctor who, again, I met while he's doing his fellowship program in college. We had just kind of reached out to him. He connected me with a couple of his friends, $5,000 there, $10,000 here. And we're able to raise just a few $100,000 in cash to help us
get
overcome.
Get started up, yeah.
Exactly, overcome that cash hump at that point in time. But in that story, as I talk about it, was it's just a lot of people of immigrants that I'd met along my journey, whether it was in college, in at different situations, that really rallied around to help lift this up and take it to the next level. I tell people this, my company Givelify, one of the reasons why it's very successful is because very early on we realized the power of diversity, and we embrace it, we tap into it. It helps us think about problem solving in ways that one person could never imagine.
Yeah.
And it's at earlier part of my career when people say, you know, what's the secret to your success at Givelify? I used to think it was the products that we built. And at some point in time, I started comparing some of the products that we built with some of the other products that might be competing with our products in the marketplace. And when I think about the ideas how the ideas that go into our products are birthed, it's from the corners of our team that we could have never imagined. And when we think about who are the people in those corners, it's the diversity of perspectives that they bring to the table that helps to these solutions that translate into products. And so I often tell people that, you know, as the founder and the CEO of Givelify, it's my God-given right to claim that we are the best. Like,
nobody, it is totally your right. Yeah.
It's my right, right?
Actually, yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, it's one thing for me to stand out there and say we are the best given product in the history of given products, right? It's my duty to do that. But when you go to the App Store and the Google Play and you look at, you know, over 50,000 people giving you 4.9 out of 5 stars, and you know you did not pay for any of these reviews, you did not buy any of these reviews, you did not, they're not from fake people. These are people who actually use your products that are saying this is the best option out there. It's very gratifying, but you trace that back and you connect the dots back to the diversity of the Givelify team. Haru is not Christian by any means, right? And he'll tell you this, he's Hindu. And so when I was telling, like, Harry, has this ever happened to you? You go to church and you're not able to, like, what are you talking about, Harry? Like, Wally, you know, I don't go to church. What do you mean? But I can relate to, like, trying to support, like, a world vision or something like that.
Yeah.
And being in this moment where I just want to do it and I'm not able to do it as well. So as we're shaping the idea, he's able to bring the perspective of a non-Christian.
Mm-hmm.
To the table,
yeah.
Right? That helps us think about a universal given product that can be used by regardless of what motivates you to give, whether it's your faith, whether it's a specific cause or passion that you have. And so having that diverse perspective really, really, really helped.
Yeah, I bet. And I mean, I think that another thing that I think is really cool about the company, and I know I've read some things about how you're not located in Silicon Valley, you're not in New York, you know, you're not in LA, you're in, you know, obviously you're in Texas and you're in Indianapolis or Indiana. And just, I know that you have been recognized and applauded by some of the local mayors or just basically the government representatives for talking about. And there was a quote that I heard, well, while Silicon Valley is often recognized as the hub for technology and innovation, you know, people like you are putting the Hoosier State, am I saying that right, on the map. But, you know, that's really cool, too, that you're bringing technology, you know, kind of in this innovation to areas that maybe didn't really kind of, or were historically not really included in that.
Yeah, definitely. So I remember if you follow a lot of tech companies, their cycle tends to be something like you have an idea, you're able to think about Shark Tank, right? You're able to go to a yeah. bunch of investors, you pitch them and they say, hey, we like your idea, so we're going to give you an angel round. And then you build the company up to a certain level and then you need to grow. And then you go back to them, they give you more money and then you grow to another level. And then so you have your Series A, Series B, Series C, Series D round. Now, at some point in time, there's an exit. And when we started GiveLify, that was kind of my vision as well, right? Like, okay, we'll go pitch some investors. And I remember doing that in Indianapolis and everybody said no. They didn't think the idea could survive. There's a lot of competition in the space. So they all said no. So I'm like, you know what? All right, I'm going to go try some other places. I spent a lot of time in Austin, Texas. Yeah, pitched a couple of investors there too, and they said, no, it's not going to happen. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go to Silicon Valley. I hear they invest in any and all types of ideas there. So I'm going to go spend some time there. And then I went there, and everybody told me no. And then, you know what? I'm going to go to the financial capital of the world, New York.
This is New York, the world's largest city, the heart of financial networks that encircle the globe.
I hear like, that's like, if I can't get money in Silicon Valley, maybe I could get in New York.
The largest single concentration of theaters, operas, music halls, and entertainment.
And I went there and everybody told me no.
Yes, this is New York, the mecca for tourists from all over the world.
And finally, I looked myself in the mirror and said, okay, all right. There's a common denominator here. It's you, Wally. Like, everybody can't be wrong. Like, there's something you're doing wrong, right? But for me, like, I had lived this problem. Like, even though I'm not able to articulate and excite investors about the opportunity, I knew the problem was real for me. So when you talk about, I want to pivot a little bit into privilege here, because I appreciate male privilege. In a way. So, but when you look at what the numbers say about how much funding goes into startups and small businesses, right? Obviously, a very, very small amount goes to minorities, right? But even in that minority, when you talk about men versus women, like it's like 0.000000 something to that goes to minority women.
Unfortunately, Wally is not exaggerating. Study after study has shown that less than 1% of the billions of dollars that is spent in venture capitalist funding goes to minority women-owned businesses.
So you think about that, And as somebody who just kind of lived all of those rejections, and then a few years later, you start to read about this imbalance between where does like startup funding go. You start to appreciate some of the challenges that are there. And again, by no means am I, because when I was like, oh, I'm a minority guy or whatever. No, if you look at the women number, I'm like, I just shut up. And it's like, I have nothing to say in this.
It's a valid point that, you know, Black and minority owners are not getting the access to capital the way white founders are, whether they're men or, I mean, so that's the reality. So did you raise then in kind of instead of getting the fundraising, did you, is that when you raised capital in your circle?
Yeah. So even after we raised the capital in the circle, right, it's not like, you know, it wasn't like a lot of money, right? So so we still tried to look for funding, but it just never really happened. And we just had to really, really dig deep to figure out a way to get things going. So
so what did you do then? What I'm like, what's the next stage in the story then?
I often talk about this sometimes is, you know, how the dejection could really demotivate you as an entrepreneur, and how you really, really need to dig deep, like to places you can find within your soul to motivate yourself when everybody keeps telling you don't know what you're doing. I think it's something that as immigrants, sometimes you just look at where you're coming from and you're able to say, you know what, I could do this. I could do this. So there's that. And then there's just the sacrifices you just have to make. And I tell people this, like, I remember I lived in this nice 2-bedroom apartment, and what I had to do then was like, okay, all right, if I could just shave off $500 on my rent a month, it could pay for something to help this company grow. So I downgraded myself into this 1-bedroom apartment. And then I looked at everything else that I had. I'm like, well, I have this car that if I sell, I could probably get $30,000 for it. So I sold the car and I was without a car. And after when that was done, Harry, I looked at Harry and said, look, Harry, I've maxed out my credit cards. I've sold my car. My only other option now is to live in a box. But before I live in a box, I need your credit cards to max them out too. So he gives me his credit cards and then I max them out.
Well, that's friendship and trust and the leap of faith as well. Different things.
It's such a good way to put it.
Yeah. And then when I finish maxing his credit card, I'm like, hey, how about that, your other friend, man? Can we maybe see what's on his credit card? But literally, that was what it was like. It was those early sacrifices that we need to make. But I think behind it all, definitely there's a personal, hey, you know, it's Wally. We could rally behind him. And then my doctor friend also who came in and we maxed out his credit cards also and started asking him to hit up his friends. But there was a community that really believed in this vision that innate to all of us, which was the vision that we saw that innate to all of us. And to explain the vision, I like to talk about Mother Teresa, right? Like if, Fiona, if you had a podcast with Mother Teresa and you asked her, Mother Teresa, do you feel like you did enough in your lifetime? Did you think you did all that you could have done? My suspicion is Mother Teresa will have probably said, there's more I could have done.
Yeah,
right?
Probably.
And we just recognize that innate to all of us, Fiona, Caroline, is like we just feel like there's always more we could do.
Yeah.
No matter how much we always feel like there's more we could do to make the world a better place. Mm. And all of these friends came together to say, you know what, how do we empower people who say there's more I could do to make it easy, so easy for them that they just do it and not think about what it takes to do it. And I think that's the vision that everybody was buying into. Until today, that's the vision that drives us. And so the answer to the question is, Fiona, no, the capital never came. But the innate desire to help people do more good filled in the gap when capital was not there for us.
Wally, and people believed in the vision, but also in you and in your ability to take it to the next level, which you've clearly done. And I mean, I think your leadership, you're so charismatic and funny and passionate about the company. And I mean, I'm not I'm surprised that you were turned down so many times by people who clearly missed out on an amazing entrepreneur. And I do think it's a conversation worth having, that Black founders do not get access to the capital that they deserve.
Yeah, definitely. So my perspective as a Black immigrant is, you know, I come from Nigeria. I go into the university bubble. And I'm in that university bubble for a few years, and I really didn't get to appreciate what was happening outside the bubble until you leave that bubble and you start to see everything that's there. And so I feel like there was this learning period for me when I left college of really understanding. I see the opportunities in America, but there was this learning curve of really appreciating how that opportunity came to place. And the sacrifices and the fight and the struggles that that preceded me, that allowed somebody like me to be able to come in here and be able to say, hey, look, I see a problem here. I want to solve it selfishly for myself, but for a lot of other people too, which is that I just want to do good. Like, I'm not buying something here, but I just want to do good. And I want to solve it selfishly for myself because I know I feel better by myself when in those moments I feel like I'm able to contribute. And when I don't, and I think about that I wasn't able to, I really feel horrible about myself. So I call it the chasing of the feel good high, right? So you can think of different highs, right? Like, you know, if you're in Las Vegas, it's a different kind of high, right? So I call it the
unless you go to the Celine Dion show, then I completely understand.
Then you completely understand. There we go. Oh, Britney, there we go.
No, but as immigration advocates, I feel that, because when we get an approval on a case, like I remember as a student when I like helped on my first case and I got an approval, it was a high.
There you go.
It was a high that I told myself that I was like, I'm gonna chase that high
for the exactly life, exactly. So you know that high, that's that high. Yeah. Every time you're able to do good, like you feel it, like and as the pursuit of that high that got us here. But I definitely don't know, because I've just experienced this for, you know, very few years of my life. I don't know what it feels like for people who are born in the United States who've had to fight this struggle over and over and over again. What I do appreciate is that the progress that's made with every generation. Every generation makes a progress. And you look at what's going on today, we appreciate how fickle that progress is. And so, my thought on that is, you know, we just got to be very vigilant and understand that it's never over. But there's a whole new generation out there that will benefit from what we contribute to towards that progress today, towards that fight.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Immigration Revelation. And thank you to Wally Mafolazir for sharing his story. In honor of his father, Olatunji, and Fiona's cousin, Owen, if you'd like to donate to Big Hearts for Cancer Patients, you can find a link in this episode's notes. May their memories and all those lost to prostate cancer rest in power. We hope this episode resonates with you and inspires you to share the gift of giving with others, especially this season. Be sure to find out more about Givelify and the team at givelify.com. Until next time.